LeanCast, Product Innovation and UX Design with Bonanza Design.
Let's not waste a second. I'm here, new episode of LeanCast, the one and only Finn from Project 33. Finn has an inspirational background, which I let him break it down for you, tell his story. But to summarize, why is he here with us? He's one of those inspirational young leaders that really break it down for audience why content in the age of today's social media and marketing is key. He has a business about content strategy. He's selling content related services. So in case you want to shape your strategies, your company strategies, your personal strategy when it comes to content, when it comes to personal branding and company branding, he's the guy. Finn, to the roof. Thank you for being with me finally after months. How are you feeling? Talk to me, please.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm feeling very good. I'm not sure I would agree with all those things you mentioned. I think I've done some content stuff, but I think there are many people who know more about that stuff than I do. But yeah, I'm happy to share all of our learnings, obviously. So thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I want to start where everything began. Uh-huh. I think I want to go back to 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Timeline is up to you. I read in amongst your amazing posts that you started early on with your own content. Can mm-hmm. you tell us about your personal story from the beginning till now?
Sure. Yeah. Well, for context, I'm 26. So 15 years ago, I would be 11. Nothing exciting happening at that point. So I'll jump to college. So I'm from Germany. So I finished high school. I went to college. I was studying physics and philosophy in Heidelberg. Beautiful city in Germany. I would say the most beautiful city in Germany. I was studying physics and philosophy because those are the subjects I was most interested in high school. And so, you know, I signed up for them and I didn't really have a plan of what I wanted to do with them or what I would do after college. I was just kind of going with the flow. And I was doing what I think most people do in college is the minimum. So it was, you know, learning and I was always good in school, so I could get by with doing little, but, you know, would mostly spend my time on watching animes and watching, you know, Twitch live streamers and basically wasting my time. And I had this moment when I was 1.5 years into studying where I realized that I was doing this for other people. I was doing this because almost like an autopilot, because that's the thing that you do in Germany after you finish high school. You go mm-hmm. to college. There's really no other path that you choose. And especially in my family, you know, both of my parents studied mm-hmm. and went to college. My bigger sister was in college. Mm-hmm. All of my friends from high school who I graduated with went on to college. So that's what you do. And so mm-hmm. at one point I realized and I decided to basically explore what else is out there. You know, sure. what else I could be doing. And so I dropped out and I basically didn't have a plan of what I wanted to do. And so what I started doing was, you know, the one thing that I can start doing right away was to document my journey, you know. And cool. so once I dropped out of college, I basically created an Instagram account and a LinkedIn account and a Twitter account and a Snapchat account and a YouTube account and all these things. And I was quite introverted at that point. So I wasn't really like, I literally didn't have an Instagram account at that point, which was 2017. I literally didn't have a Snapchat. I didn't have a Twitter. I didn't have any of these things because I was spending all my time on Twitch and watching animes. And so that's how it started. And I just documented. So I was, you know, just posting videos of myself, you know, with the thoughts that I had and the, you know, oh, I could try this or I could do that. You know, people I was meeting, people I was running into, you know, little things that I was doing on the side, just, you know, plain documenting it. And I was pretty, you know, I would say open about it. Like I was open about the fact that I dropped out of college. I was open mm-hmm. about the fact that I didn't have any clue what I wanted to do. I was open about the fact that my parents weren't necessarily excited about me not mm-hmm. being in college. And I think that resonated with people. And so I started kind of growing on Instagram and on LinkedIn. They had just launched, Microsoft had just bought LinkedIn. And so they had just introduced native videos in September 2017. And in December 2017 is when I started posting videos on LinkedIn. And so I just kind of got reach just for that fact, just because there was no one else really out there putting videos on LinkedIn. Because my videos were shit. I mean, I was just, you know, talking about random stuff. There was no cohesion in them. But I was authentic, I think. I was just, you know, pouring my heart out, basically. And so I started gaining a little bit of traction. And at some point, the one of the big kind of decisions that really changed, I would say, the trajectory of my life was that when I dropped out of college, I moved back to my parents because, you know, I didn't have any money and I needed to just get by. And so I moved back to my parents and I started having like a job and making some money on the side. And at one moment I realized that I was too comfortable, you know, that I was, because you can have all this idea of, I'm going to like do my own thing and I'm going to try things and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to start a business and all these things. But when you live with your parents, you know, you live with your parents. And so, you know, my mom was still washing my laundry and stuff. And so at this moment where I was going for a walk in my little town in Bremen in Germany, and I was listening to music and I was like, I need to get out of here. I need to go somewhere. And I was like, what's the craziest place I could go to? And I was like, New York. New York, like that's the craziest place I could go to. And I don't know how I knew it back then, but I knew that I needed to come home from that walk and book the tickets right away.
Wow.
And so that's what I did. I came back from the walk. I went straight to my computer and I bought the first tickets to New York that I could get, which were 5 days later. And so 5 days later, I was in New York and I didn't know anyone. Never was in the US. I was never really outside of Germany. It's not my native language, though I had decent English skills. I knew two people who I connected with on Instagram through these like videos that I was posting on Instagram who were in New York. And so I DM'd them and I was like, yo, I'm going to be in New York in 5 days. You know, can I sleep on your couch or something? One of them replied and said, yeah, you can sleep. You can sleep not on my couch. You can sleep on the floor of my room in this, you know, in the shared apartment that I'm living in. So that person's name, Adrian Vasquez, amazing person. He's now, I think, the creative director for Ryan Serhant, if anyone knows that person. And he picked me up from the airport and I slept at his place for like 3 days. And wow. Then his landlord kicked me out because it was like, you're not paying. You can't just stay here on the floor. So then I went on couch surfing and I found this like ratchet place. We can talk about that. Was like probably a very bad decision to sleep there. I could have, you know, easily get, I don't know, murdered or something at that place. But I ended up staying there for 2 weeks because it was for free. And I kind of got by in New York through those types of thing, like couch surfing for free. I was like living off of cashew butter because New York food in New York is like freaking expensive. You know, right. Like a little salad at a salad bar is like $10. You know, and so I found this like little corner store, this bodega, and they were selling this expired cashew butter. And it was like, I think $8 for a massive jar of cashew butter. So that was my sustenance because I could get like two or three full meals out of one jar of cashew butter. So that's like $4 to $3 per meal. That's how I kind of got by. Then I was in New York and again, I didn't have a business. I didn't really have a plan. I was running through savings pretty quickly, but I was still documenting, posting videos. And now I had some more exciting content, you know, because now I'm this weird college dropout who just randomly flew to New York and meeting all these new people. So I think that also helped with the growth. Like I just had better content, more exciting things. And again, like I knew that the most important thing that I could do in New York, because I didn't have a plan, I didn't have any people who I knew except these like two people who I like connected with on Instagram, was to just meet people. And so what I would do every day is I would go to 1, 2, 3 meetups every single day. So I would go to meetup.com and Facebook events, and I would just search for free events. And I don't care what it was. Like, I went to blockchain meetups back in 2017. I went to like professional business networking. I went to photographer meetups, Instagram growth hackers meetup, you know, yoga in the park. Like, I didn't care what it was as long as there were people. And then just try to make friends. And that's really how it all started, you know. And then it slowly kind of picked up just momentum. I was growing more followers, both on Instagram and LinkedIn. I was meeting more and more people. I was getting better at this whole social media thing, because that's what I was doing all day, every day, just like creating vlogs for YouTube and posting on Instagram and posting on LinkedIn every day. And at some point, two business owners kind of independently of each other kind of approached me and said, hey, like, these videos that you're posting on LinkedIn, that's really cool. Can you do that for me and I'll pay you money for that?
Oh, wow. That was organic.
That was organic. And that completely blew my mind, because I had no concept of like freelancing and business. I was just like this random kid, just literally posting videos on like YouTube and Instagram. And yeah. And so at that point, I had a friend who was already like a freelance ghostwriter for people. So I said like, yo, I have these two people who said they want LinkedIn videos and want to pay me money for that. What do I do? And so basically we teamed up. He already had, you know, he knew what a proposal was and he knew what an invoice was, you know, all these things. And so we together kind of took on these first two customers, and we did a horrible job. Not because we didn't try, like I think we, you know, we poured our hearts out into these customers, but we just had no clue about, you know, it's one thing to create like LinkedIn videos for yourself as a 21-year-old talking about life. It's another one for like a 45-year-old business owners who specifically wants to generate customers, you know, and they have a very busy schedule and all of these things. So we lost those two customers. We broke up as co-founders. It just didn't work out. We had different ways of doing things and philosophies. Sure. And so that's how it all started. You know, that's what then later became Project 33. I started out on my own. I had to leave New York after 6 months of kind of surviving there because they kicked me out. I wanted to come back. I couldn't. That's what got me started on kind of nomading and traveling around, because I was like, I want to be in New York, but they won't let me. But I don't want to be in Germany. That's too boring. So I just started traveling, and I went to Bali for 6 months and Mexico and Peru and all these different places. And yeah. And so that was kind of 2018 when that started. Mid-2018 was New York. And then mid-2019 was when they didn't let me back in again. And I started from scratch again on my own. And now we're 8 people, so that's why I say, you know, I'm no expert. You know, we're an 8 people company, and not all of us are full time, you know. So, you know, there's many people out there who've built much more impressive things than I have or we have. But, you know, that's kind of how we got to where we are now.
One of the things that I really admire about Project 33 and like yourself is that feeds like your personal choice of where I want to be, how I want to work, is prioritized highly.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me a bit about this? I feel like you scaled Project 33 to this, to where it is right now, while you've been traveling all the way, right?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. Yeah, it was a transition. When I first started this kind of towards the end of my New York stay, and then when I went to Bali and Cape Town, it was very different. I was working, you know, 12 or 14 hours every day. My whole life evolved around trying to grow this. I think partly out of insecurity, because I wanted to prove to people that I have what it takes to, you know, grow a company and scale this and hire people. Like, I just wanted to, you know, and I was following people like Gary Vee, and, you know, it's all about hustle and the grind and all that. So I was like very bought into that. So I was working all day. I had one of those rainbow calendars, you know, where every minute was scheduled from like 7 a.m. to like 10 p.m. Everything was scheduled, even like the 30 minutes of reading in the morning and the 20 minutes of meditation in the morning. Like, everything was in the calendar, color-coded. I worked all day of the week. So I worked Monday through Sunday. There were no days off. And what really changed it was meeting what now is my wife. You know, I met her and I was never in a relationship. I never had a girlfriend before her. And I wasn't looking for sure. Like, it wasn't in my mind that I'm going to have a girlfriend because I have a business to grow. And so I met her. We met. We dated. She was demanding more of my time. You know, she wanted to meet me. And I loved seeing her. I loved spending time with her. Whenever we met, it was just magical. Mm-hmm. We could talk for hours. But because I had this idea in my mind that you have to grind, you have to work, you have to do this thing. That's how you prove. Like, I took pride in how many hours I worked. You know, I took pride in telling people that I got up at 6 a.m. every morning and got to work at 7 a.m. and finish at 10 p.m. Like, I was proud of that. And so that's how I was prioritizing her. You know, I was like squeezing her in, giving her like a lunch hour on Wednesday, and I was giving her like 2 hours on Saturday afternoon to like have her, you know, a little spend some time together. And at some point she was like, this is not cutting it. You know, if you want to do this, you either have to prioritize me, and that means giving me more of your time and bandwidth. Or if you can't do that, then we break up, and that's fine. But I'm not going to do this whole thing thinking that it might turn into something when you clearly don't want to prioritize this. Mm-hmm. And so we literally broke up because I told her, yeah, I can't do this. I need to grow this business. I need to hustle. I can give you 2 hours on Thursday, but like, that's about it. She was like, okay, then we need to break up. Mm-hmm. And very lucky for me, I flew back to Germany from Bali at that point because it was my grandma's birthday. And so I flew back to Germany for her birthday. It was her 85th birthday. And the good thing about flying is for like 13 hours, you're without internet.
Yeah.
You're without interruptions. You can't really work. And you're just sitting there on your own with your thoughts.
Yeah.
And that's the moment when I realized, oh shit, what did I just do? That was the first one. And then the second one was when the first day when I was back in Germany for my grandma's birthday, my, you know, Anastasia, the person who's now my wife, we were kind of still chatting on WhatsApp, and she sent me this voice note saying something like, and my other ex-boyfriends. And that word hit me so much because in the same moment, I realized that one, she had considered me her boyfriend, which we never talked about. We were seeing each other and we were dating, but I never realized that she considered me her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I'm now her ex-boyfriend. It's over. You know, this is like history. You're like,
yeah.
And I broke down crying and I called her and we had this chat and yada, yada, yada. And I basically decided in that moment that I want to be with her and that this is important to me, clearly, because I was very emotional about it. I just didn't realize it because I was overworked. Like, I was just not in touch with my emotions. I never had a single moment of self-reflection where I was just alone with my thoughts and my emotions, and recommitted to her. And she didn't believe me, so I had to prove it to her. We met up again, and I needed to show her every day that I would prioritize her. And that forced me, because I chose to, really cut down the hours that I was spending working. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the start of the transition to realize that there's more to life than work, that there are more important things than scaling a company, that I had other interests that I was just not allowing myself to have because I had this idea that it's you derive your self-worth from how many hours you work. And, you know, now I think about things very differently. You know, I love running Project 33.
Right.
But I do many other things. I spend lots of time with my wife now. We're married now. We have a kid coming. And, you know, I have other projects. I have a book club that I'm running. I have a little app that I have on my side that I'm building. So, you know, now it's about like, what do I actually want to do rather than what like some business gurus or whatever tell me what is the thing you should aspire to.
If you were to use time machine and the 26-year-old Finn want to go back to 5 years ago, 4 years ago, and talk to the 22-year-old Finn, you know, and offer him advice on how to run your day to day, what would you say to him?
I find this question always very hard because I'm very happy with where I am.
Right.
I'm with my wife. We married. We have a kid. I have a company. So would I have wanted that person to maybe realize what I now realize earlier and prioritize other things in life and, mm-hmm. you know, not broken up with her initially and just stuck with her? Maybe, but then maybe life would have turned out very differently. And things mm-hmm. people have tried, by the way. My best friend back then, Jay, mm-hmm. who's now working with me at Project 33, like he told me often, like, yo, you need to do other things. You need to get out of your, you know, little bubble of working. There are other things to life. How about we go explore and drive to this place or explore that place? And I was always like, no, I have to hustle. I have to work. Right. This is important. So it's also like I might have not believed if I would have come back, you know, and told myself like this is what you need to do, because I was mm-hmm. stubborn. I had mm-hmm. to go through that experience of having that breakup and then realizing kind of how I emotionally felt about it and to arrive where I am today. So,
and how do you now juggle different activities? You have a book club, you are working on an app, and you have obviously Project 33. So yeah. Because this is a different take than all this hustle porn that we see on LinkedIn that, hey, you need to be laser focused on one thing. You have to give it all you can. Yeah. So you come across as relaxed, as secure, as grounded. Also, based on what I see and observe your journey, your hero journey, you seem to be running a growing company as well. So for all the entrepreneurs out there, creative folks out there, that they, because one of the challenges that I see all the creative folks are facing, and one of the area that we talk a lot internally at Bonanza Design, is that creatives are multidimensional.
Right. Yeah.
You cannot just design forever. I tell my friends, my team, it's like, hey, it's really okay if you want to do another major while you're working with Bonanza Design. Yeah. We have people in our team, they're doing two majors while doing Bonanza Design.
Love it.
Right? So I'm really aware of this, but on that level that you are operating, which is taking you, there is a lot of responsibility. There is a lot of operation that you need to manage. How do you juggle these different activities?
I think one is just to realize that that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I do have all of these different interests, and I do have the drive to like read a lot. And I do want to talk to people in my book club, and I do want to spend time with my wife. Like these are natural instincts. And so I think it's just about allowing that. Because before that, like I was just not allowing it. Like I was just suppressing it basically, because I had this idea that it's all about hustle and you can only focus on one thing and you got to work a lot of hours and that's what you take pride in. And once I kind of got rid of that, those outside voices, and just connected with what I as a person want to do, it became much easier. And then I think it's just a practical thing of making it happen, right? Because once you know what you want, you can work towards that. So it's not always perfect, right? Like sometimes there's things happening at Project 33 that require my full attention. And then, you know, I cancel my book club hangout with that week, or I, you know, don't work on my app for a couple of weeks. Or, you know, I tell my wife like, hey, today I'll be in the office until 8 p.m. or something and or later, and then I'll come home, right? So it's, and some weeks there's just not much happening. It's just, I think, following more the flow of life and being okay with, you know, like, and I still struggle with that. Sometimes I, you know, I have goals or projects or things that I want to do for Project 33, little new processes I want to build out, new things I want to focus on. And then I work on them, and then it's 2 p.m. or 3 p.m. and I'm done with all of my things. And then to say, okay, let's go home, or let's go for a walk, or now let's listen to a podcast or read a book or hang out with my book club or spend time with my wife, instead of saying, oh, it's only 2 p.m.
Yeah,
I could pick up another project. I could I could check my email. I could, you know, answer a couple more messages on LinkedIn or write up a new post. Like I could fill this time until like 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. But just saying, no, this is kind of a natural breaking point. I worked on the things that I wanted to work on. I know that I made progress because those were important things that I worked on in the day.
Yeah.
And now I just focus on other things instead of, and I still struggle with that. Sometimes, you know, I feel bad for leaving at 2 p.m. when everyone else is still sitting there, you know, at WeWork, like friends of mine who have their own business and like working there until 6 p.m. where you ask yourself, shit, am I just a lazy person? Mm-hmm. But I think that's just society, this idea of like, you know, if you don't work this amount of hours, you're a lazy person. You're not disciplined. And I think that's just bullshit. If you, if you're excited, like if you have projects and you're like pumped about like doing things until like 6 p.m., go ahead. But like, so it's just that, you know, once you realize that there's multiple things, and I think it's what you said, like people are multidimensional. Mm. What are we doing trying to put in ourselves into some kind of box?
Yeah.
Because some business guru told us that you need to work, focus on one thing for 10 years. You know, it's like, if you want to, you know, design things, but you also want to run marathons,
right,
then do that. You know, like that's who people are. And I think life becomes much more rich and fulfilling and fun and meaningful when you allow yourself that. And maybe there's some kind of trade-off in terms of income. You know, maybe you will make a little bit more money if you force yourself to work 12 hours every day and remove all your hobbies and side interests and you know, your relationships. Maybe, but I'm not sure that that's, you know, that's preferable.
100%. So it's always about the trade-off. Like, okay, maybe if you work 12 hours a day, you might have 30%, 20%, 40% more in your annual income. But yeah. What are you losing? Are you willing to lose the love of your life? Are you willing to lose your side hobby or like marathon that you're like really like passionate about? So even the book that you wanted to read or the course you wanted to take. So I really feel you. I think this is such a like a sobering message for entrepreneurs that, hey, relax.
Yeah. There's one really, or two really, because I think we still need to see it in the world to believe it. And, you know, I'm ambitious. You're ambitious, you know, where we feel like we want to build something. We want to contribute. We don't want to just like watch Netflix all day and chill, you know. So there's two stories that kind of help me relax into that a little bit more. The first one is about Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about it in his commencement speech that he gives at Stanford or something, that, you know, he went to college and then he dropped out to start Apple, what became Apple Computers. And when he dropped out of college and he, you know, didn't have to go to all of these courses anymore that they forced onto him, he could actually go to the courses that he was interested in. And one of the courses that he enrolled into was calligraphy, you know, the art of writing beautifully with a pen. And he did that not because it has some utility, but because he was just interested in it. And he talks about how later when they developed the first Macintosh and they developed the typefaces for the Macintosh, his experience, what he learned in that calligraphy course and typesetting course, fit into what they were designing there. And he attributes to some part of why the Mac was so successful, because it was just aesthetically pleasing and well thought through in types of the typesetting and type forms and all these different things. And that's not, and that was just because he followed his, and so he talks about how you need to follow your curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
I think he phrases it as follow your heart, and then trust that later on the dots will connect. But you can't do that looking forward. Like you can't enroll into calligraphy and be like, I'm going to do this because in 5 years I'm going to develop a computer and then I'm going to use this knowledge that I learned now to put it into the computer and that's going to help us sell more computers and, you know, grow the company. It's just like, follow your interest, and then at some point it will somehow connect. Maybe if you're interested in marathons and design, like, you know, I don't know, you'll be able to combine those interest at some point in a unique way that no one could foresee except you, because you had this unique overlap of different things that weren't directly connected. I'll skip the second story for now because I think it will take too long and it's similar.
And that's something I think we need to have more conversation about that. Entrepreneurship is not an easy path. It comes already if you want to say, hey, if you want to really like devote, it's like having an, like I told my wife that, I already have a baby. This is my first baby. Anything mm-hmm. else that comes would be my second baby, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a, you know, literal analogy. It's,
yeah.
But it has truth to it, so to speak, because it takes up a lot of your time. Obsession, you know, waking up at 3 a.m. thinking about the business, what you want to do, like sure. Countless amount of hours thinking about doing it. So I think it needs to be a new pattern, it's sobering take on entrepreneurship that say, hey, you don't have to get to success in 1 year. No one can. Business is always, success is always correlates with accumulation of small wins, and small wins comes in long term. So if you're not willing to invest in this thing for the next 10 years, this is not, entrepreneurship is not it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it also comes down to designing your company to fit your lifestyle rather than mm-hmm. the other way around.
Love that.
Like a lot of people, you know, they change their lifestyle for the sake of growing their company more. You know, they start reading books that they're not interested in because they think it will help their business. They will pick up, you know, hobbies and, you know, meditation or whatever, because not because they want to do it or they enjoy it, but because they think it's going to help their business. And so, you know, we've said no to customers that, you know, would have wanted to pay us money, but because I realized that it would have needed us to change our process, or it would have forced me to hire a new person that we currently don't have, or it would have forced me to myself get involved in the service delivery because it's deviating from our standard offering. And the obvious thing to compare yourself to and measure yourself by in business is revenue and profit, right? It's giving you such an obvious metric to measure yourself by and compare yourself to others to. And so sometimes we forget that revenue and profit are just means to an end, mm-hmm. at least in my opinion, to live a good life, mm-hmm. right? If you have more revenue, you have more profit, you have higher income, you can, you know, enjoy certain perks in life. But if the trade-off is not worth it, if you have to give up quality of life to somehow increase your profit or revenue, to me, it's just not worth it. To me, it's much more important that I have a level of income that allows me to stay in my lifestyle, which is not the cheapest, right? We live in Berlin and we like to travel and I love expensive things. But what's even more important to me is being able to read for 2 hours in the morning mm-hmm. or to leave the office at 3 p.m. and spend the afternoon with my wife. And mm-hmm. so if additional revenue comes at the cost of me having to sacrifice those things, at this point, I'm not going to make that trade-off.
It's beautiful. And I really appreciate that we get to a point that we talked about this, designing your company to fit your lifestyle. And it comes also with a lot of self-awareness and soul-searching. Who am I? What do I want to do? What kind of footprint I want to leave? And one of the folks out there on LinkedIn wrote a post, and I don't have it in my mind completely. The gist of it was, people ask me what my mission in life is. I don't know. I'm just like, you know, I'm just like going and doing my best every day. And sometimes it's too much for me to know that at the end of the day, at the end of the hard day, to realize, oh gosh, I don't know anything about my mission in life.
Yeah.
It resonated so much with me. You know, I've been in the path of entrepreneurship for a good 12 years.
Yeah.
And if I tell you I know completely I'm fully aware of my mission, I would be lying to you flat out. Right. Yeah. And I think I would like to preface that not everyone knows. I think just it's such a difficult mission to have to know, to realize your mission.
I think that's one other thing that these gurus preach, which is you got to have a purpose, you got to have a mission. What's your purpose? And you know, I think that's one of the good things. I don't know if you feel the same way, but I think that's one of the good things of marrying and now having the kid on the way, which is, that's my purpose. You know, and a lot of things that I now think about when I think about Project 33 is in those terms. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be able to give my family, my wife, and then my kid that's, you know, going to be in the world soon, to give them a good life, to give them, you know, I want to be able to provide them shelter and food. I want to be able to give my kid a good education. You know, I want to be able to provide for them. And so that drives a lot of my decisions about Project 33, how that fits into that. And again, if some higher revenue in Project 33 comes at the cost of me not being able to take care of my wife emotionally, or, you know, just not being able to spend time with her, then it there's no point. And I think people look down on that a little bit in today's age, mm-hmm. where it's like, it's all about career, right? And you got to have a career and accomplish something. And when they say, when, you know, you say you're a housewife or you just stay at home dad or something, people kind of, you know, look down on that because it's like, that's not really a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not, you know, you gotta fulfill yourself through your career, through your job. And it's like throughout like history, you know, family, I think, and kids have been the biggest driver of purpose. And so there's nothing bad in that. And I think I'm also not delusional in the sense that, you know, because these gurus tell you, you got to have a mission and a purpose. A lot of, I feel like founders feel like they have to create some mission or value out of the vacuum. And they always got to be grand and ambitious and changing the world and, you know, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. With Project 33, we produce videos for founders. Mm-hmm. If I hustle more and I'll work 12 hours a day and grow this and scale this, the result of that will be that there will be more videos of founders on LinkedIn. I'm not changing the world, and that's fine. You know, like I'm not saying that's bad. Like Project 33 is amazing. I get to work with interesting people. Mm-hmm. I get to work with a team that I enjoy. I mm-hmm. get to provide jobs and income to people who might have not otherwise have access to that. You know, we're obviously providing a, you know, solving a problem for companies that now can do things a little bit more efficiently and maybe get more customers and streamline their marketing a little bit clearly. That's what people pay us. And it's providing me an income that I can use to explore other interests and buy books and buy food and travel. And it's providing me a constant stream of problems that I can solve, right? It's constantly forcing me to learn some new things or figure. So I'm loving it. I'm just saying, like, there is no grand, you know, purpose around, you know, this whole thing. And I think that's totally fine. It's like people almost feel bad when they don't have that.
Right. One of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation with you, that you are a prime example of someone that has a dropout college, started with social media marketing early on 2017, and turned that passion for communication or passion for capturing one's hero journey. I mean, passion for just, you know, expressing yourself, you know, what happens yesterday, into a business that is, you know, growing business. There are a bunch of folks around it that been helping other businesses to communicate their objectives better to their audience.
Yeah.
So why content is important for creatives?
Mm-hmm. So when I dropped out of college and I started documenting, the reason why I did that was really just because I thought that wherever I end up, whether I start a business or, you know, go to, you know, become an actor or, you know, whatever it is that I end up wanting to do, if I document the step-by-step thing that I went through to get there, some people can take something from that and get inspired and learn something from it. That was the thing why I decided to do it. Mm-hmm. As I started doing it, I realized that it actually enabled me and accelerated my search of finding something and building something. Because one, there's a couple of ways to think about it. I think one way is just to think about networking, right? If you don't know what you want to do and you don't know anyone, it's really hard. Like, how do you find that out? And so one thing that you can just start doing is to network with people, meet friends, talk to people, you know, present what your thoughts are, discuss, debate, make connections, help them in some way. And then over time, you're doing two things. One, you're getting new inputs. You know, some people telling you, oh, I have this agency, and oh, I have this e-commerce thing, and oh, I'm helping people do that. And it just gives you inspirations where you're like, oh, I could see myself doing that, that you might have otherwise never discovered if you hadn't had met these people and talked with them. And two, you now have supporters and a network. So that once you run into that first thing where someone tells you, oh, yeah, I'm like doing pottery. And you're like, oh, pottery sounds fun. I should try that. You now have people that you can reach out to ask for help or to say, hey, I you know, built this thing. Would you be interested in using it? So you now have, it's much easier to start. And so the way that I think about content is just that, but online and at scale, right? Because what you do at a networking event is there's 20 or 30 or 100 people, and you go to meet those people and you introduce yourself and you tell them who you are and what you do and what you're learning, what you're up to. And they tell you what, who they're on, what they do and what they're up to. And then there might be a match, right? Where you'll, oh, you're working on the same thing, or, oh, you're, you know, maybe I can help you, or maybe you can help me, or maybe you could use the thing that I'm building. And that's what content does. When you just talk about what you're doing and what you're up to and what you're thinking about and what you're building and what you're experimenting with, most people won't care. And some people will be like, oh, there's a match. That's what I'm working on. That's what I need. How about you help me with? And that's how, you know, Project 33 started. You know, I didn't create videos because I was like, this is the path and then I'm going to start. I just created videos because I liked it. And then two people saw it and were like, I can use this for my business. That never occurred to me that a business owner would want to create videos on LinkedIn. Right. And so then they reached out to me and they said, hey, can you do this? I'll pay you money. And I was like, oh, damn. Okay, I'll do that. You know, and so it's just networking at scale. And I think, especially in the beginning, what I would say is just don't niche yourself down. I think that's one of those advices that people tell people when they talk about content, like pick a niche and then talk about that and focus. I would again do the opposite and be like, talk about whatever you are interested in. You know, and if there's no cohesion, that's fine. That's what I did, right? I was just like, I'm meeting this person. I'm doing that. I'm traveling to New York. I'm going to drop out. Here's my LinkedIn videos. Here's what I'm learning from Instagram. Just anything. Because then you run more experiments in a sense. Because most of the things people are not interested in, most of the things you do, people won't find value in. So if you like sit down as a college student or whatever, and you're like, I'm going to talk about investment advice. It's like, you don't know shit about investment advice.
Right.
And you don't know whether that's the thing you're really interested in.
Right.
And so you cut yourself short. Rather, you should talk about what you think about investing and your hobbies and football and this and Twitch and whatever you want to talk about. Gives more area, surface area for someone to see something that they resonate with or that might help them. So yeah, that's really how I thought about content. That's how I still think about content, even with Project 33, right? When we produce videos for these founders and business owners and executives, it's just to scale networking. It's to get their face out there, showcase what they know, showcase their expertise, build trust with people, build rapport with people, start new relationships that they can then take offline and have a Zoom call or follow up with that will benefit their business and maybe other parts of their life.
So a lot of questions from what you just said. First thing I want to ask is that I am chief product officer of, not chief, but senior product manager of Company X.
Yeah.
Should I come on LinkedIn and talk about what I'm interested generally, or should I be just talking about what my expertise is about?
I think it depends on the goal. If the goal is to generate customers for the company that you're chief product officer at, then you should talk about what you're building and what the product is and the lessons you're learning and what the features are and, you know, how it fits into the market and, you know, build trust and awareness and around those topics. And that's if you're the chief product officer and, you know, you're paying an agency like us out of the company budget, then obviously that's what you're almost morally obliged to do, because like your company's paying for that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they're doing this because they hope and want that this will drive the company goals. Now, if you're a chief product officer and you want to explore your other interests and you want to explore other career opportunities and you want to see whether you can turn your side business where you create jewelry into a proper business, mm-hmm. then I think you should spread yourself more wide and talk about your product stuff, but you should talk about your jewelry side project, and you should talk about, you know, what you've learned about managing people, because maybe some other company sees that and they're like, we need a new chief product officer. They sound smart, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it just depends on the goals.
Got it. I am very doubtful as a person who runs a design studio. We have a team of three marketing, but whoever that I look up to, and all this marketing guru, they say, you need to be everywhere. Is mm-hmm. it true? Do you need to be on all platforms? Because it's just too much to maintain all of this.
I don't know. I think it's just a matter of like trade-offs, right? And resources.
Right.
It's like, you know, could you reach more people and potentially generate more customers if you are active on LinkedIn and on YouTube and on Instagram and on TikTok mm-hmm. and have a podcast, you know, and go on interviews and have, you know, interviews in the New York Times and in Forbes and like, sure. I mean, it's just a bigger surface level. You reach more people. But right. what it's going to take is more resources, right? More people working on this, more time of maybe you spend on it, you know, more money, you know, spent on, you know, outside agencies, one for the PR and one for the podcast and one for the this. So it's just a matter of resources. And I think when you're kind of like us, you know, we're eight people, like mm-hmm. we just don't have the resources to be omnipresent and do everything. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you just need to decide. And I think where you need to decide is like, what's the biggest bang for the buck, right? Because you have limited resources. So you need to want to be smart about that. And so I think it depends on the business, right? If you are a B2B company selling to senior, you know, decision makers, heads of customer experience, blah, 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 then I think just LinkedIn is just makes a lot of sense, because that's mm-hmm. where these people spend their time mm-hmm. and where you can reach them based on job title and all of this. You know, if you're selling to 17-year-olds, you know, and you're selling some fidget spinner, you know, e-commerce stuff, then you should be on TikTok. And mm-hmm. that's where you should focus on. And then as you, you know, have more resources and more people, you can expand into the other platforms where the bang for the buck might be lower, but you can still reach additional people.
Got it. I want to talk about personal branding. So I want to sort of like allow you to go all over the place. What is personal branding for individual? How? Because personally, it took me some years to understand, oh, wow, there is a personal branding for me. I have an understanding of it now, right? But it took me a while, and I feel like for a lot of folks out there, it's still not clear. So then there is another side, is that I talked to my business, you know, the CEOs in my network, like, hey, yeah, we are doubling down on our paid marketing, performance marketing. Right, we got the branding team to do a brand for our company and stuff. So now we're ready to just, you know, scale it up and just do a lot of performance marketing and leads and what have you. And talk to those people why it's important to invest in personal branding.
Yeah. So this is very trite. People buy from people. So what I think about when I hear personal branding is, well, one thing that people say, and I do agree with it, is everyone has a personal brand, whether you do personal branding or not. And your personal brand is your reputation. What do people think about you and say about you when you're not in the room? Oh, Berat is such a trustworthy person. Oh, he's so interesting. Oh, he's so smart. Oh, he's so thoughtful. Oh, he's kind of annoying. He always talks about TikTok. Oh, he's, you know, these things. He's hardworking. He's lazy. Like, that's your reputation and that's your personal brand. So everyone has a personal brand. So when I think about personal branding, the activity, it's kind of like networking, right? So you go to a networking event in person, 20, 30 people, and you talk to people. You like introduce yourself. You're like, I'm Barrett. You know, I do this. I, you know, have a company, blah, blah, blah. And you can either box yourself in and pretend that you're this robot that just, you know, does design. And that's your whole life. And that's the only thing you talk about. And maybe some people are interested in that. But generally, when you do that in person, people are like, that's kind of fake a little bit.
Right.
I don't feel like I know this person. This is just like some like stream of thought. And the only thing he ever talks about is design. It's like, is that all he is? You know, I don't know anything about you. Like, do you have kids? Are you married? Where do you live? You know, what are your hobbies? Are you interested? And that's how we, by the way, evaluate whether someone's trustworthy. You know, like we look at them and we hear them talk and we see their facial expressions and we evaluate kind of the context of their life and how it relates to us, right? Some people, when you tell them I'm married for 5 years, they immediately think about you differently because they're married. You know, if you tell them that you have kids, if you tell them you live in Berlin and you love the city and your favorite author is, you know, Nassim Taleb, you know, some people are like, oh, I love Nassim Taleb. And they immediately have some connection with you. And so what people usually do naturally when they go to a networking event is like they don't only talk about their professional stuff.
Got it.
You know, they introduce themselves. They're like, I'm Barrett, you know, I'm married, we live here. Oh, I just got into wine and it's so fascinating. We went to this trip to California and we did this wine tasting and it was, you know, so enriching. And then the other person like, oh, I love wine too. Like, what's your favorite wine? You know, and you have that. And then you eventually get to the professional thing and you're like, so what do you do for work? Oh, well, I run this company. And then it's on another level, right? Because you have some context, you know the person. They're more than just like this persona. And that's to me what personal branding is when it comes to content. So you can either just box yourself in and be this like design persona that only ever talks about design. And when someone asks, who's this person? They're like, I don't know. He just talks about design all day. So personal branding just means to incorporate these things into your content that you would naturally do when you meet someone at a conference or at a networking event. We share a little bit about your personal life. You share a little bit about your hobbies. You talk about being married and what you're learning there. You talk about, you know, living in Berlin and what it's like and how it's informed, you know, how you think about different things. And so what it does, I think, is one, it makes you more personable, makes you more likable because people, you're more relatable. It, again, it gives more surface area because now, you know, instead of just appealing to people who are design obsessed and just want to learn about design all day, the people who are also into wine or also into reading Nassim Taleb or are also living in Berlin or are also married with one kid, there's something I can relate to this person. I like this guy.
Right.
You know, and so it gives you more surface area. It builds trust with people because, again, that's how we evaluate whether someone is trustworthy by getting this context. And so I think that's the personal aspect, and that's what we try to incorporate when we create content for customers. We have three content, overarching content categories: subject matter expertise, company, and personal. Subject matter expertise are all your expert content, right? What do you want to be known for? What are you an expert in? Might be design, might be content, might be software, might be healthcare, might be this or that. That makes up roughly 75% of the content that we create for customers, the majority. Company stuff is more general about, you know, what it's like working at this company, you know, the team members, how you started this, the founding story, you know, your mission, your values, your principles, you know, how you run it, the softwares you use, the lessons that you've learned, just to give people a little bit of context about, you know, what's this company, where are they based out of, you know, that's 12.5%, so 1/8. And then personal, and that's also 12.5%, 1/8 of the content. And that's more just like, you know, what are you interested in? What's the book you recently read and what are your takeaways? You know, what podcasts do you listen to and what have you learned from them? You know, who is the person who taught you the most in life and what are the lessons that they've taught you? You know, what's your story of moving from there to there? And, you know, what can you give people who are going through that same transition right now?
Sure.
So it's not the majority of it when we do content, right? Because we generally do it for senior decision makers who want to, again, talk about their expertise. But it's a 1/8 of it. And we found that that kind of roughly works. For you, it might be 50%, it might be 5%. Everyone needs to find their own balance. For me, it's a little higher. But I think it shouldn't be zero.
Right.
You know? And you can incorporate into things too, right? When you talk, and we try to do this with as many of the pieces of content that we create for customers, when they talk about, you know, here's three saying things to design a better website.
Right.
And you can just talk about that, you know, optimize the CTA, or you can talk about that and embed a personal story. You know, I arrived at this when we had our first customer, you know, and I was working on this and we put it live and it just, no one clicked. And that made me think about, you know, like add a little extra, because one, it's going to be more easy to consume because people love stories. It makes it more memorable. But again, it adds context to you. It makes you more relatable and likable. And so we try to do this with as many pieces of content that we do, even if we talk about some expertise stuff.
There is a distance between how CEOs, marketers, business people, growth hackers think customers buy products and services, and there is an actual behavior.
Yeah,
that is, you know, I think in 2022, it's very clear for everyone that we live in the age of digital economy. Right, this is now, it's now everyone, I think, now on board with this. And you recently wrote a really cool post about how you switch from Slack to Basecamp. It was today. Oh my goodness. And I was, and when I read your post, I realized, oh my goodness, that's exact, not exactly, but that's similar to how I purchase things.
Yeah.
Like, especially for people like us, that we get a lot of offers from other providers that they want to sell us services. We sort of like, I'm sort of like, as soon as I see one of those email or LinkedIn messages, I just like mark them as read or archive them right away, because I know, just no, like, you know, you're knocking on the wrong door or you're coming in from the wrong door. But the way you described it really hit home with me. And I would like to, you know, it's been 58 minutes of really cool conversation. I want to end it with this. What is the map of today purchasing? How do companies go about purchasing new services?
Yeah. Well, I think first off, it's different for every company. So that's the preface. It really depends on your price point, who you're selling to, what market you're in. You know, how, do you have a lot of competitors or no competitors, right? It depends on a lot of things, what it actually looks like for you. But I think in general, and we generally work with, or we exclusively work with B2B companies, which generally means, you know, high ticket price and complex buying centers, right? You're selling some expensive solution to another business. $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 that companies need to commit to. And oftentimes it's not just one person who is involved in the decision-making, but two or three people who, you know, need to sign off on the deal. And so when you're in that position, people don't impulse buy that stuff. You know, it's not like you show them one ad. It's like, we have a lot of happy customers. And then people are like, oh, wow, click the link, go to your website and put in their credit card information to purchase a $50,000 offer service from you, right? Obviously, that's not how things work. It's not like you send them one cold email and say, we're really great, how about you do this? And they're like, oh my God, I've waited for this all my life. And they click on the cold email and go to your website, book one call, talk with the salesperson for 30 minutes and are like, let's do this, sign the contract and commit themselves to $100,000, you know? So everyone knows that that's not how things work, but sometimes we hope that they work this way. And sometimes we measure our KPIs as if they work that way, right? Where people want to be like, let's put a link in every video that we post so that we can see when people click the link and go to our website and book a demo and close, and we can track it back to that one video. No one buys a complex B2B product based on one video that they watch. It takes time. It takes time for them to run into a problem and realize that they have that problem. It takes time for them to become aware that there is a solution for that problem. It takes time for them to evaluate what solution, you know, they like best and would work for them. It takes time for them to actively compare companies, see whether they can fit it into the budget and get everyone on board. So all of that takes time, sometimes many months, for these big buying decisions. And so the post that I was writing about was about how we at Project 33 made the decision to switch all of our project and task management, project and task management for the whole company from basically Slack and Monday.com to Basecamp, which is a big decision, right? Because you're going to move everything over and that's what all the people at your company are going to use. That's not an impulse decision. And so the way that it happened for me is that, and that's what I write about, is I discovered one of the founders in a random podcast that I listened to on the Tim Ferriss podcast. I liked it. I liked what they were talking about. So from there, I searched up his other podcast interview and I listened to a couple more of his interviews on other podcasts of this founder. His name is DHH, David Heinemeier Hansson. And from there, I followed him on Twitter. And I followed him on Twitter for a couple of weeks. That's how I found his co-founder, Jason Fried, and I followed him on Twitter. Then from there, I read a couple of their blog posts, right? And was like, I'm interested in what they have to say. And from there, I graduated to reading their book. They wrote a whole book about It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. That's their book, highly recommended. And only after that, eventually, I was like, okay, let's switch to Basecamp. This whole process, this is like weeks and months, right? Because I first listened to a podcast and then eventually listened to a couple more and then followed him on Twitter for a while. Then over time, read a couple blog posts. Then I read the book, which took me a while. And then it took me some time to think and massage it in before I eventually made the decision. But this whole process enabled me to, one, get to know the people, get to know these founders. I liked them. I trusted them. I got to build rapport with them. I got to learn about their philosophy of how to get work done at work, which I bought into. I agreed with it. I thought they were making really good points.
Right.
And throughout the process, I discovered that they have this company which creates the software called Basecamp, which was not at all why I looked into them, right? I just found him on the Tim Ferriss podcast. And that made it suddenly very easy to just at one day, one random day, I was like, that's it. Switching. And I think that's how it works for a lot of B2B companies. And I think what that means for them practically is, one, you want to enable, I talk about the 7-hour rule, which is a really valuable concept. It's the idea, and there's some psychology research around it, that on average, it takes people 7 hours to make big decisions.
Right.
So when you buy a car, you don't impulse buy a car and you go to the first car dealer and buy the first car you see. You go to one car dealer, you go to a second car dealer, you go to a third car dealer, you watch a couple of YouTube videos comparing this car to that car, you think about it, you talk to your wife about it, you ask some friends what their experience has been. That's your whole research process. That stretches out over weeks and sometimes months, right? You don't pack that all into one day.
100%.
And that time roughly adds up to 7 hours. Now that's an average. Maybe it's 5 hours, maybe it's 10 hours, but on average, 7 hours. That roughly, you know, fits into my buying journey of buying Basecamp. And so when for B2B companies, you want to think about how you can make it very easy for your prospects to spend these 7 hours with you and your company and your product.
Wow.
To learn about what you guys do, how it works, what the product is, you know, who your customers are, what the success have been, what your takes are on how to approach design and what your philosophy is and how you get work done and what your processes are and what you've done before and what your background is. All of this information that people need to make a buying decision. And what that means is making it easy is to put it out there, right? To have it on LinkedIn and YouTube and in an email newsletter and on your website for anyone to see at any point without opt-in, without a gate in between. What most B2B companies do is that they have some information on the website.
Sure.
Generally, it's quite, you know, broad and not specific and kind of wishy-washy because they're scared that their competitors will like steal something from them. And then the only way for anyone to get this kind of information is to book a sales call and to ask a salesperson.
Right.
And that's really annoying because people don't want to talk to salespeople. And they don't, and they just want to learn a little bit about your philosophy and a little bit about your product. They don't want to schedule a Zoom call on a Wednesday afternoon to talk to some rando at your company to know that, to find that out. They want to just find that out. And so I think that's what companies need to think about when they think about, you know, making it easy for people to buy from them.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. No, that's radically different from what performance marketers and these growth hackers offer to companies, that especially for high ticket contracts, it's what you have told me. I put myself in that shoe, that I'm trying to buy, I'm actually in the process of buying certain services, exactly doing what you have told me.
Yeah.
Like, I have been spending several hours up to now, because I'm thinking about certain service I would like to buy, talking to different people, listening to the podcast. I really want to know who this person is.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like your mental model, if I want to work with Project 33, your mental model, the way you look at things at the founder, would affect all the processes that you design for Project 33 and all the services I'm getting as a result of those processes.
Can you rephrase that?
So your mental model, the way you work as the founder, as the brain behind the company, let's say, let's assume that you are the one who designed the processes.
Yes.
Would influence and affect the design of all the processes of Project 33 and trickle down to all the services I'm getting from Project 33. So I really want to know who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. And I mean, that's why there's different products. You know, different people have different philosophies and approaches, and you need to have a fit with that. And we try to practice what we preach, right? That's why on our website, you can see the price of our offer, even though we're B2B. We have basically our full process out there, like exactly how we write copy, how we edit videos, what they look like, who's in the videos, you know, all this stuff. We have a whole 40-page document on how we write copy for customers. And you know, there are trade-offs to that. Like I've seen now a couple of companies that have stolen things from us or taken things from us, which, you know, is kind of nice, I guess. It means that people like it. You know, I know some companies who are literally using our copywriting guidelines to train their in-house people, but that's amazing. I mean, that's great. That means that people like what we put out there. And I think that's why people are often afraid, because they're like, our competitors are just going to steal what you do. And
right.
I think you're always a step ahead of the people trying to steal your processes, because what's on the website, there's already two further iterations that we're using internally right now. But it also means that when people book a demo call with us, you know, they usually already have buy-in for the price. They already have buy-in for our process. They already kind of thought about how this fits into their processes. So the questions that they come to me for are very specific. You know, I don't answer the question, you know, what's the price point? It's like, you're going to answer that on every single call. You can answer on every single call what your offer does and what the features are. You know, you're going to waste a lot of your salespeople and your time.
100%. 100%. And really admire you for this way of looking at business and doing business, actually. It's very honest. It's very clear. It's very transparent. It comes across from the point that I really don't want to waste my time first and foremost. I have priorities in my life. I can just get off this. I could have not have this call with you, because, and then go to my family and my friends and read my book. So for me, and it's very smart too, because it helps you to have shorter sales cycle.
Yeah, and I think that's, it's a win-win, right? Because like, if someone didn't see our pricing on the website and comes to the call and asks me what the price is, I'm not going to be like, it's on our website, you should look there. I'm obviously going to tell them the price. I'm not going to be an asshole about that. But the people who want to know the price before booking a call, because they want to know, like, is this $500 a month or is this $5,000 a month? because if it's 5,000, there's just no way I can afford it, even if it's amazing. And so for those people, it's just good that they don't even have to book a call and just quickly check and know, you know. So it's a win for them too, because they want to be able to do their research on their own time without having to have a gatekeeper that will tell them, you know, on some sales call they have to book.
Sure. This is officially the longest episode of our podcast.
Oh, no. Stream.
Yeah. It's packed in with a lot of like different angles. We started really wide and now we got down to really practical tips for businesses. I would like to thank your time. I know you could be anywhere else. Thanks for squeezing this one in your schedule. Love this conversation. Any last word for the audience?
No. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. This was fun.
Thank you. Ciao. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.